Thanks for joining us. We're going to get right to it. Today's going to go quick. It is the Power Hour. We're only doing 1 hour. So if you want to get in, you better press one on your phone here pretty quick because the lines are filling up with questions. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking, and today is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power, and this is the show where we take your calls and answer your questions about every maintenance, engines, modifications, troubleshooting, upgrades, fuel economy, horsepower, you name it. We'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give us a call. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. I want to bring in the guys from Pittsburgh Power. Bruce, Ethan, John, welcome back, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Kevin.
Kevin, it's always a pleasure.
Great to have you here. So, John, we got a couple things. Bruce, Ethan, more news about the Nikola truck. I'm going to cover a few things there. John, I'm sure you have some things to say. And then we'll see if we got anywhere on our EMP homework as well. The Nikola truck. You know, if this thing turns out to be real, I'll be the first one to say that I'm wrong, but I still have my doubts. It's kind of interesting. I went all through their website, and every number that I questioned when I did the big write-up and did the Facebook post and talked about it on the air, every number that I questioned is gone. The only thing they left was the weight, and I made a big deal about how they had that so wrong, and they kind of fixed that. Now they say, well, depending on configurations, our truck will always be lighter than a standard Class 8 tractor. But they changed all their numbers. They took away all the numbers about extra profit because of the lower weight. That's gone. Most of their cost comparisons are gone. The price of the truck has gone up. It was $350,000. Now it looks like it's $415,000. So many things have changed in such a short period of time that I'm wondering, why did it take them to roll it out to figure out all the things that were wrong? You know, if you're putting together a truck this complicated, you have to have some pretty intelligent people. And this is obviously a big undertaking. And yet their first rollout was so bad, it looked like a hoax. This one looks a little better. Looks like they have some pretty big names behind it, but I'm still just not seeing it. John, what do you think with the new info?
Well, I think I'm a little more of a believer now than you. I'm not quite ready to start eating that big plate of crow yet, but I'm really close to it. The some of the numbers don't add up. A lot of things have become more realistic. Even the 1,000 horsepower number, I don't quite believe in because – yeah, the 330 kilowatts of battery plus 220 on the fuel cell, if it's all running at full capacity, only comes out to 737 horsepower. So if there are no losses whatsoever with the storage they've got there and the capabilities they've got, they can't make more than 737. But that's – and there are losses. So whenever you convert that DC to AC to get the variable speed and then back to DC to drive the motor – you know, you're going to lose things. There's going to be heat generated. There's stuff that's going to be gone. But that said, I mean, it's all taken a turn to be more realistic. The people involved, you know, we've got our friends at Fitzgerald that are going to be building the first ones. Pratt & Miller is the one that got me. I've got four fairly close friends who work at Pratt & Miller. And Pratt & Miller is probably the sharpest engineering firm in the country. I believe that, you know, the work they've done in racing, they've won Le Mans numerous times. They are General Motors' racing arm. So those Corvette and Cadillac race cars that you sometimes see used in advertising, since road racing exists in a vacuum in this country, Pratt & Miller builds those. So if they've gone to Pratt & Miller, Pratt & Miller's lent their engineering expertise, Pratt & Miller could build this truck themselves, no problem. So I'm a little more believer than I was. Will the numbers add up? Will they be able to meet the price that they've offered? Will there be profit in it? No. I don't know that any of that exists just yet. But, you know, philosophically, I think it could happen. And they've got some, like I said, Pratt & Miller alone to me is enough to be a believer.
Well, I'm closer to believing that something is going to happen. Before, I wasn't sure if the whole thing was just a complete hoax. Now I see something is going to happen. I'm still just really leery of the kind of numbers they throw around. Like you said, that's a big difference on horsepower. Here's another one. I thought maybe this was a misprint, but I found it in two different places. They claim that they've raised $4 billion in pre-orders. Now, I did the math. Maybe I did the math wrong. Maybe somebody else should do this. That's 2.6 million trucks somebody ordered.
Right. He actually, in the video, if you watch the whole video, he said $3 billion in the video. And then I've seen in print the $4 billion number a couple of times since. But yeah, he flat out admitted to $3 billion in the video at the presentation. So that's a lot of, you know, if someone's listening that sent in a deposit, let us know, because, you know, we've got there. That's enough trucks that we need to know somebody who's done it.
I didn't think for sure that we had 2.6 million Class A trucks on the road.
How many are there? Bruce, you know that one, don't you?
Oh, I've heard, I heard one time 16.4 million, and then I heard, no, it's like 4 million. But I would go with the 16.4. That was told to me by OOIDA several years ago.
Okay.
That's another problem. I've never gotten a good number of how many truck drivers there are. The highest number of drivers I've ever seen published was 4 million. So I don't know what the hell going on with the other 12 million trucks. I don't think the 16 can be right. One of the problems is sometimes people will use a number that includes classes of trucks all the way down to class 3. Now you can really numbers.
I've got Ethan Googling this right now, so we're gonna see what the Google has to say about it.
Let's say
Kevin,
there is.
I also heard one time. Go ahead.
Well, I just can't imagine that there have been 2.6 million of these trucks ordered. I don't care how many trucks are on the road. I don't think that could even be close to being right.
Yeah, that'll be crazy if it is.
I agree with that, because I was also told, I was in a conversation with some other people in the industry several years ago about that 16.4 million figure I was told, and they thought it was around 4 million. So you've heard 4 million. I've heard 4 million once. So let's go with the 4 million. And so it's hard to believe that enough people could come together and 400,000 for 2.6 million trucks. But
well, here's the other number, and I won't get this exactly right, but I've seen a statistic of trucking companies. So that means an entity with their own operating authority, not an owner-operator leased onto another carrier, but entities with their own authority. I've heard that, like, there are over 100,000 trucking companies with less than 5 trucks. So those guys aren't ordering this thing, certainly not this early in the game. So even if you have big fleets making huge orders, which I kind of doubt, the example they gave in their own press release was of a company that ordered one. Well, come on. You don't have a better example than that? Somebody that ordered maybe 100 or 1,000, but even if you have fleets ordering a couple thousand, you can't get to 2 million trucks. I can't believe that they're putting that number out there.
Kevin, according to Google, the total number of trucks in all classes is 26 million, but the Class 8 ranges from 2.4 million to 4 million, depending on who you look at.
Okay. And that's and more like what I thought.
There's something like 16 million registered trailers, though. There's lots of them.
That's true, because most fleets will keep a 3-to-1 ratio trailers to trucks, and some will do more. So that I'm not surprised on the trailer side that there's that many. But we were pretty close on they're claiming 2-point-something to 4 million. Based on his numbers, everybody who owns a Class 8 truck in the country has just ordered his.
Oh, well, do we have that math right? Because if it's divide 400,000, let's say the truck costs 400,000. Divide 400,000 into 3 billion, let's say, because he said 3 billion in the video.
Oh,
what's that come up to?
Okay, I'll tell you where I went
wrong.
Yeah,
we can't go with it. We can't use the 1500 number. The 1500 number represents a $400,000 sale. So he's talking pre-sales total, in total sales, not actually money generated.
That's where I screwed up my number. I thought he was talking about how much revenue they've generated already. Okay, now the math might make a little more sense. All right, we're going to get to a break. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about, and we'll be getting to your calls and questions. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and John and Ethan with me. We're talking about the Nikola truck. Now, John, that makes more sense. We're talking maybe 7,000 to 8,000 trucks ordered now.
Not even. So if it's $400,000, let's say, and let's go conservative. Let's use the $3 billion number he used in the video, as opposed to the $4 billion we've seen in print. At $400,000 a truck, which is going to be close to, that's 7,500.
Yeah.
So that's 7,500 orders. That's plausible.
Easily. It wouldn't take very many fleets. And this guy obviously is sharp. He's got a lot of people involved. There is a lot of money behind this. 7,000 to 8,000 trucks ordered. I could easily see that. I thought they were talking about how much revenue they've already generated, because it's going to take an awful lot of money to do this.
Now, at that number, though, at $1,500 a piece, that's $11,250,000 in deposit. So, I mean, that can get him a ways. I mean, he could do a lot of work on that $11 million. So,
yeah,
interestingly, he may really well have funded some of his prototyping and his work here on the deposits. So,
possible. That is a lot of money. There's no question. The other thing. You know, and I'm making some comparisons to the Elio, because I've been watching the Elio from very, very early on, watching all their early prototypes, watching them try to get manufacturing up, trying to bring partners in, designing a new engine from scratch. And the Elio is a drop-dead simple vehicle. I mean, it's a three-wheeler with a body on it.
I follow that one, too.
Yeah, you look at the struggles they're having just with regulations alone, and they went with the three-wheeler. One of their primary reasons was because they get away from the regulations that are on automobiles. They only have to meet the regulations for a motorcycle. Much, much easier hurdle to get over. You start looking at what it's going to take to bring a new DOT-approved truck into the market. The other thing about Elio, like almost every project, they have been years off on their delivery date. Like, I was supposed to get mine 2 years ago. I still don't know when I might get mine. And I'm one of the really early depositors, and I still don't have a date. Now, I see Nicholas talking 4+ years before this will actually be in production. And if they're off on that, how much further is it going to be?
Right. Yeah, you could. I think you could probably be safe to double that.
Yeah, it's kind of what I'm thinking. I think this was exciting. It's an awesome looking truck. The technology is amazing. I'm not sure how you pull it off at that price. The other thing he talked about in the video a lot, he kept stressing that this was for owner operators. I thought it was a little weird that their example there was for a fleet, and they kept talking about owner operators. But the other thing is, who's going to finance the owner-operator on a lease that's $7,000 a month with a total risk of $500,000? I mean, I don't know many owner-operators with that kind of credit.
Yeah, I don't either. Even if the profits, even if there are no fuel charges for that whole time, I don't know how that works out. There's going to be other maintenance. There are other things that are going to go wrong with it.
Well, that's the big unknown. I did some math, some pretty quick math, and the numbers don't look that bad. People say, oh my God, $7,000 a month. But honestly, $7,000 a month, if that includes the truck, the fuel, the scheduled maintenance, not breakdowns, but it did include scheduled maintenance, it's $84,000 a year. Well, I can go generate $150,000 in revenue with that truck. There's still 70 some thousand left in profit. I mean, that number is not that far off. Even though it sounds scary to say 7,000 a month, with everything included, and that's up to 1,000,000 miles. That's fuel, scheduled maintenance, everything for 1,000,000 miles. Our big what if are breakdowns. What is it going to cost to tow this thing to a rider center and get it fixed? So I don't know. Interesting stuff, though.
And, a full 1,000,000 miles out of the batteries, I think that's going to be – they didn't say anything about a battery exchange program. I know that's a deal with Tesla. They do them, and they expect you to change them at 100,000. So is that going to be, a 1,000,000 mile – is you going to do 10 sets of batteries in 1,000,000 miles? So that's another thing that could be interesting.
I see
and at that
so
point,
ways that this could just go wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yep. But conceptually, I agree. And it's the same thing that we've been dreaming about here for a while. They've just been able to beat us to it. But, Bruce has wanted to build a diesel electric truck for a long, long time. Conceptually, I believe it works. I'm pretty sure all the technology is there. I'm not sure if battery technology is quite up to snuff yet. And in all these numbers and claims that they've got, I mean, we are generating electricity as well on downhills and so forth, like I wanted to do with my hybrid axle. So, energy storage to me is really the big frontier beyond, because that is, I don't want to say something for nothing. You did generate it by going downhill with your heavy truck. But that is where the difference is made and the ability to do that. Whether the thing's got a hydrogen fuel cell or a hydrogen turbine or a diesel turbine, even like the right speed stuff to extend the range, that's here nor there. But the fact of the matter is now we've got a vehicle that's going to save some energy and generate some of its own gumption on its way down the hill, just with stored energy from the weight that you're slowing down, which to me is the heart of the next frontier.
Well, and there's no question it's exciting in the fact that this is, looks from the outside like such a huge undertaking. Like, you almost think you would see, taking a standard Class 8 truck and starting to modify it towards the diesel electric. But they're making this one giant leap all at once into all of this technology in one truck, which is exciting, but it's also, when you look at the history of bringing new technology into the trucking industry, it's been a disaster. I mean, simple stuff. We screwed up anti-lock brakes the first time. We screwed up disc brakes the first time. We screwed up wide singles the first time. We screwed up all the emissions the first time. We don't have a good track record of bringing new technology into this industry.
Well, that's every industry. There's a really cool engineering book. I think it's called Design to Fail, but it's the role of failure and successful design, and that's going to happen with everything. You know, that's just how it works. You got to do it wrong at least once before you figure out a way to do it right. And no matter what our simulations tell us and how sharp the engineers think they are, there's always going to be some sort of a glitch early on. And I think they are putting the cart before the horse too. You know how strongly we feel about building our hybrid axle or our, you know, an assist axle, you know, to start capturing some of that energy. And you know, we're going to would like to take a conventional truck or a regular diesel truck and, you know, give it the ability to store some energy and help it back out. And, you know, I think we're so efficient. The modern engines are so efficient, and some of the work that we've done on the older engines have them, you know, reaching modern efficiency, that, you know, the next frontier really is going to be that energy storage. But why no one has gone that route yet? I know Eaton's got a cool little hybrid unit, and there are a couple other things. There are like hydraulic accumulators and crazy things like that to try to store energy. But, you know, the technology works in a Prius, and it works in a Chevy Volt, and it works in a Tesla. And there's really no reason not to do it other than, you know, money to fund the project.
Yeah, well, it's going to keep us talking anyway, so it's interesting. Now, here's another question. We could tie in our other topic. What do you think it would take to protect this truck from an EMP?
No, it's done. It's toast.
Yeah, this one might have some issues with that.
This one doesn't
You opened a can of worms with that one. I studied a little bit, not as much as I should have, but I had phone calls and emails from some people that I'm pretty sure wear aluminum foil hats. Thanks. Yeah, you really opened one up with that.
Oh, boy. All right.
Yeah,
well,
so
go ahead.
It's an interesting one. It really is. And again, when you read up on that, yeah, there are quite a few legitimate articles on it. And there are some really, really crazy stuff out there on that subject. So that's one. We'll save that for another show. We'll get to some phone calls, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one more thing to look up if you haven't come across this yet. It's called a Faraday cage. Have you seen that yet?
Oh yeah. I've heard of that. Yep. Yeah. That's
kind of what they think might protect electronics. If you build these little Faraday cages, you can.
Faraday,
they're not
yeah.
that all complicated.
Yeah, Faraday,
but,
Faraday cup. Yep.
All right. Well, we're coming up on a break. We will head into the break and we'll come back. We'll get right to your phone calls. We'll hold off on the aluminum foil hat topic for another show. We will. We'll come right back and get to your calls right after this break. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. If you want to join us on our recordings and our podcasts, real simple. You can get on our text message list, and that way every time we're going to do a recording or a podcast, we'll send you a quick text message 15 minutes early with the phone number to join us. Nice and simple. All you have to do to get on that list is text the word listen to 99,000, 99,000. Text the word listen, and then we'll send you a text with a phone number and a time when we're doing our podcast and our recordings. We'll be right back with more stuff. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me. We're going to get right to your phone calls. We're off to Idaho. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 97 Kenworth with the N14 engine. My question is, what oil pressure should you be running under load down the road? It runs at a 32 pounds of pressure. When it's cold at startup, it'll go up to 40. What is the acceptable range?
Okay, I'll answer that one. At 32, you're a little bit low. There's a pressure relief valve It's a spring and a valve that goes in the oil pump. They're very economical and very easy to change. And that's something you might want to look at.
Okay. That's what I wondered. I've heard on some of the, like, maybe the newer ISX, there's a thermostatically controlled valve, but this is in this older engine, it'd just be a spring controlled valve.
It's a spring and a plunger, and it's about 3/4 inch in diameter and about 3 inches long.
And just pull the oil pan to access that oil pump?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And some of the older NTC Cummins, it was external. We just had to take a plug out, slide that right out with your finger. And sometimes if you were looking for 5 pounds or 6 pounds, you'd put a washer underneath it.
Yeah.
Just to tighten up on the spring a little bit. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very
much. Okay. You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Pennsylvania. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Speaker. Hey, I am restoring an old International 4200. It's a 72, and it's got a 318 Detroit in it. And I was wondering if there was anything I should be worried about running today's fuel in that old engine, and also would it be beneficial to run synthetic oil in it, and, you know, how about the coolant? How will the coolant of today do in that engine?
Well, a 318 two-stroke Detroit, we stayed away from those, never did work on them. So we are not the people to talk to on that. So I would not put synthetic oil in. I know a lot of them, they want straight 40 weight. They don't even want a multi-viscosity oil. So you really need to find yourself an old two-stroke Detroit guy and ask him those questions.
And,
I'll jump in
with just an opinion. Bruce, I'm with you on the oil. I didn't have a 318, but I had a 6V92, and every Detroit two cycle I knew of, when you pulled into the truck stop, you topped off the oil and checked the fuel. I mean, they were just oil burners, no matter what you put in them. So I certainly wouldn't go with the lightweight synthetic.
What do you think, should I try running an additive with a fuel? Because I know with a, I don't know how the low sulfur fuel, you know, should I add something for lubricity when I put fuel in it?
By all means, you should put Lucas fuel conditioner in that fuel.
So you think with every tank I should put it in?
Oh, gosh, yes. 1 gallon treats 400 gallon. I would probably make 1 gallon to 250 to 300 gallons.
So let me ask you a question real quick. What's the reason, like, what's the number one reason you're going to build this engine, this truck?
Because it's my dad's old truck. My dad bought it new back in August of 1971. He hauled pulpwood with it, and it was his favorite truck, and it was mine too. We loved that old truck, and after 30 years, I hadn't seen that truck in 30 years, and I started looking for it here about a year and a half ago, and I finally found it. It was parked out behind some guy's barn in a field, and we are restoring it for my dad. My dad's 80 years old. He doesn't know we have it, and it's going to be done probably by Christmas, and we're going to give it to him.
That's
a great
awesome
story.
By the way, that's the only answer I was looking for, because there's no other reason to rebuild a 318.
Well, we love the we love the sound of it.
Yeah,
when it's done.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to hear this thing start up just takes me right back to my childhood, sitting in that passenger seat and riding with them. Just the sound of that engine kind of makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
Yeah, I love that story. But I would say oil, I would go with a heavy oil. I would probably even put Lucas in the oil, probably a gallon, just to keep that thing from burning so much. The fuel additive would be a good idea as well. Yeah, great stuff. Let's go to Georgia. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Hey, quick question. I was up at Pittsburgh Power about 2 months ago. I got an 03 Classic with a 12.7 and had a power box put on, OPS, and your mufflers put on. I've seen a little bit of improvement, about 2/10. I just recently had the truck in or engine in framed back in August at a Detroit dealer. And my question is, I heard, Bruce, you talking in a show not too awful long ago about shifting with the boost gauge and something about 8 pounds or somewhere at the bottom end there where we can improve even that. Can you kind of enlighten me on that?
Some people are, they have their truck geared to run so free that they can cruise across the interstate at 58 to 62 on 2 to 4 pounds of turbo boost. Now, years ago, we wanted everyone to stay around 10 or less on the level. And now we want to see it between 4 and 6, 8. But it takes super single tires, 264 gears running in direct, some aerodynamics. But the lower you can keep the turbo boost on the level, the better the fuel mileage. Now, you said something that raised a red flag. Detroit rebuilt the engine. That means they got into your ECM. And do you still have the stock wastegated turbo on?
No. Okay. They claimed they did not get in the ECM. And then when I brought it to you guys, you got in the ECM and set it back to put the power box on there. So, and it does not have the wastegate turbo on it.
All right. That's a good thing. What transmission are you running?
13 speed.
Trailer do you pull?
53 van.
And where do you mostly run?
Well, we stay in the southeast, south center. We run a lot of Houston, but we do run some Midwest. We're probably the biggest rock we go over is Mont Eagle, and you know, so we do run heavy a lot, and so you know, with a classic, no aerodynamics, you know, we're doing between 6.4 and 6.5, which is probably reasonable. The only thing I've not put on there yet is the FAS and the fleet air filters, but I've pretty much made all the other modifications that you recommend.
Okay. All right, when you're on the level, at what speed are you going, and how many pounds of turbo boost is it taking?
Well, it's actually my son-in-law drives it, but we run it in 12th gear most of the time around 62, which is around between 1650, probably around there in RPMs. And as far as boost on the level, I'm not sure. I know when he pulls the hill, it gets up in, even up into 30 and low 30s, the scan gauge.
Sure. Well, you have to use power to go over the mountain, but it's on
right.
The level is where we have to make our fuel mileage. So what I want you to do is find out from him, what is the average? How low can he keep the boost gauge when he's on the level? And is he loaded both ways?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's some of the things we need to know. And how big is the gap from the back of the bunk to the front of the van?
It's probably only about 2.5-3 feet. Not a big gap.
Well, that's good. Because they say air can only jump 36 inches. What rear gears do you have?
370s,
okay. If you run it at 1,400 RPM in 13th gear, does that help?
Actually, we found that running a little higher RPM, like up even 17 or even 1750, it does better, at least on the scan gauge, it's showing better numbers on there.
Just a real quick question about that. Have you tested the Charge Air cooler?
Yes. I, in fact, had it replaced last year, and Pittsburgh Power just checked all that. Y'all did the
okay.
You had a 200.
Sometimes when we see an engine that does better way up at that higher RPM, sometimes we're overcoming a leak, but it sounds like you've got that taken care of. All right, we've got to get to a break. We're going to come back. We've got one more segment. We're going to get to as many calls as we can. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power, and we're going to head off to Indiana. Les, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Just for budgeting purpose in the future, what would, on a DD15 and a Cascadia, a basic in-frame cost me, and then what would the signature out-of-frame with the line boring cost me?
Wow.
Well, on average, an in chassis, on average, an in chassis on most all engines is anywhere from 18 to 24,000, depending on what you're gonna, what changes you're gonna make. 18,000 is really low, and that's basically liners, pistons, rod and main bearings, head gasket, fan gasket, set of injectors, and a head. And then you look at dampers and balancers and ported and ceramic coated manifolds and things like that. So, and computer programming. And so on average, I would figure 22 to 24,000. Now, when you start going out of chassis is when you're 2 million miles. So, or unless there is a wear problem with the main bearings. So I don't think you're going to see that yet on a DD15, unless you have, you have that kind of miles on it.
I'm looking at DD15s with 500,000 right now, and I'm trying to, you know, plan for in the future so that when I do need it, I have the money in the bank.
All right, the future is 1.5 million miles away, so I wouldn't be worried about that out of the chassis. That's a long way away. Okay.
All right, perfect. Thanks a lot, guys.
You're welcome. Let's head off to Florida. Trent, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you? How are you guys doing?
Good.
A couple of quick questions. You guys, the DD15, I was out there was with John. We had a vibration in my truck, and we were trying to find it, and had a few issues. But anyway, how are you guys coming with the programming on the DD15?
We probably did the first one about a month after you were here, Trent. I remember you pretty clearly. How you doing?
All right, yourself?
And they're great. They're working really well, so we've got that ready to go. So, you know, whenever you want to get back up here, we've got a nice program for that. We're seeing a small increase in mileage and a big increase in performance across the board. You know, some of our guys who run a little heavy and fast haven't seen a whole lot on the mileage, and we've had reported as much as 6/10 improvement on the mileage. So, you know, depending on how you drive it, you'll probably count on about 0.25 mile per gallon once you learn to drive with the extra power. And but the power is incredible. Everybody's really, really pleased with the power they're making. And we haven't seen any check engine lights or any other issues with it. So, yeah, so we're ready for you.
Good deal. And my next question, are you guys going to become an authorized Detroit dealer, so to speak, like Cummins and Cat?
I don't believe we have any plans to do that, Bruce, unless you know something I don't there, if that's something that had been explored that we'd worked on, but not at the moment. I don't see any plans for that.
Okay.
The only way you can do that is become a Freightliner dealer.
Gotcha. Okay.
So all we right. can't just be an engine dealer then.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Lastly,
you don't have to. You don't have to worry about me becoming a Freightliner dealer at this age. So.
Listen, I don't blame you. I ain't mad at you, Bruce. Not at all. Lastly. I've got 247 gears in here. At some point, well, there's a buddy of mine that has a 13 can get from him, and I was looking to put a 13 in here instead of this. I've got a straight 10 direct, and I like the 13 speed. Well, most people do, and I think it would help even with fuel economy. What's your opinions on that, anybody?
Well, first of all, you said direct. If it was a direct drive, you'd have a 50-mile-an-hour truck. So I don't think it's a direct transmission. In fact,
well, according to the specs, I put it that way.
Bruce, hold on. Right now he says he's got 247 gears, so that 10-speed is
exactly.
Direct.
Yeah, that would work with a direct.
Sorry,
so fine.
I thought
yeah.
I heard 347.
Yeah, no, 247.
Okay, so 247.
Yeah, so when you go to the... When you go to the 13 speed, my guess is that it's a double overdrive. That's the most common by far, which means you're going to 10th gear in your current transmission is going to be identical to 11th in that 13 speed. So your top speeds right now, you're going to be running those in 11th gear. Then 12th is going to go faster, and 13th is that gear you use when the cops are chasing you and you don't want to stop.
Right, exactly.
But if you're out west in the flat and empty or light, I mean, you could use that 12th or 13th to just keep the revs way down. It would depend on how the other gears split. I'd have to look at the actual drops between the gears to see if that would be a worthwhile change or not. You do have one more gear between low and direct, so that can't hurt. And then if you were able to, would have to see how all the gears fell in that arrangement to see if that would be a worthwhile change for you or not.
Okay. All right. Just thinking, if I can get something.
Here's the one thing to keep in mind, because I get this question a lot. Changing a transmission. Now, you have a friend who has it. Maybe you're going to get a good price on it. Maybe you're going to do the work yourself. That would all matter. But if you want, I get people who say, I'm going to take my truck in the shop. I'm going to get a 13 speed. You're probably talking $8,000 to get that done. And the odds of it affecting fuel economy are slim, actually. You might pick up a tenth or two, maybe. Sometimes you may not pick up anything. On the other hand, pull into Pittsburgh Power with $8,000 in your pocket, and it's like Christmas, and you'll pull out of there getting a mile and a half to the gallon better. So it changing a transmission just to change a transmission is one of the last things on my list, unless you can just get it done. But even if you're down into the $3,000 or $4,000 range, there's so much more you could do with that money that would improve fuel economy and performance a lot more than changing the transmission.
I mean, that's true. That makes sense. And you're right. It was just a question. You know, it's not that I really had it as far as, you know, on my top list. It's just that he told me about it. I said, well, let me throw the question out there first to see if it's even feasible. You're right.
It's definitely feasible, and I would rather have this truck with the 13 speed. I just can't see the cost justification when there's so many other things you could do first.
Right. Well, I'm again only getting it for $3, so that's the only reason why I thought about it.
Yeah.
Well, $3. That's a good deal.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good. Listen, guys, thank you. John, always a pleasure. Bruce, I met with you years ago. I know you don't remember, but always a pleasure dealing with you guys. Kevin, love your show. And just keep doing what you're doing. We'll keep listening, trying to do what we're doing. And I'll get out there as soon as I can, John.
Yeah, come on up as soon as you can. You'll like that tune.
Okay, good deal. Appreciate it. You guys have a good one.
There you go. Thanks, Trent. Let's squeeze in another one. Let's go to Illinois. Dennis, welcome to the program.
How you guys doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I just bought a 2003 Volvo off my old boss. He shut it down. He got older and everything. I picked it up for $15. It's a ISX. He's got a new ISX in it. I drove it for 200,000 miles. It's got 220 on it. I got some part numbers and serial numbers. I'm not really sure. I know you're not a fan of them. It's got a 13 speed under it with 355 gears in the back. I was kind of wondering what's the first thing to do to it, kind of where to go. I know an oil sample would probably be the first thing. I hear like
well,
ISX.
Well, let's let John answer. Let's let John answer this because John's becoming the ISX expert.
You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong with that oil sample. They're prone to wear cams prematurely, so that'll give you an indicator of that. Bypass filtration on the ISX is paramount. We need to do that right away if it's not on there already. Then I'd go straight to tuning from there. What year is it? Do you know which ISX it is?
You know what? I don't know. I got a part number if you guys can define that, if that helps.
Is there a number that begins with CM? Should it be CM 870, CM 871, CM 2250, something like that?
No, I got a DR 6255RX, and I got a serial number, which probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's not going to do much for me right now.
I've heard ISX 13, ISX 14. I know when he bought it, he was supposed to get a motor that fit the 2003, but they didn't have it, so they gave him a newer motor in there. but it doesn't have the EGR, doesn't have none of that stuff on it.
That should be a 571 then. It should be a CM571. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we could do a lot with that one. That's a great engine. Yeah, we can. Okay. That's very tunable. Yep.
Yeah, I definitely look like working with you guys. And you said probably the first thing to do with it would be get the OPS on it, huh?
The OPS on it. Get an oil analysis done. Let's do an overhead on it. Get a look at the cams. Like I said, there were, you know, whether Cummins, you know, I've not heard anything that them admitting to maybe having a bad batch of them, but I've seen so many cams come through here that were prematurely worn. And so, then we get some that last forever, so it's not across the board. So there's a, but you need to get a look at those pretty quickly, and your oil analysis will tell you, or we'll just get the cover off the top and run the overhead, and we'll see them then when we do that. But it's just good maintenance first, and get the bypass filter on there. They're prone to putting a good bit of soot in the oil, and they're also, you know, prone to wear. So let's get that taken care of first.
All right, and with that, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're all out of time. We'll do it again soon, so plan on joining us. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you next time. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow for Destination Health.